Okay, so we're already 5 minutes late. Perhaps we should start the second part. So I'm very pleased to be introducing the second part of our double header, as our quaint ex-colonial cousins say. Very distinguished double header in the Lakatos Award series, and now we're going to hear a lecture from Professor Deborah Mayo of the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. Deborah graduated initially, I think, in mathematics, and then moved on my philosophy and maths, and then moved on to higher things in philosophy, getting a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. She's become somebody whose papers everyone has to read over the past decade or 15 years or so. Just to pick out one highlight from her publishing career, there was a paper called Novel Evidence and Severe Tests, which overcame the enormous disadvantage of having a quite substantial chunk discussing two very obscure philosophers of science called Zaha and Worrell, to be selected as the as one of the papers for inclusion in that year's Philosopher's Annual, which contains the 10 papers that everybody is supposed to read in philosophy, whatever their field for that year. And of course, most recently, her book Error and the Growth of Experimental Knowledge, which was which has been justly selected as one of the co-winners this year of the Lakatos Award. And today she's going to talk about error, statistics, and the philosophy of scientific evidence. Professor Mayo.
I'm very honored to be here today giving one of the two Lakatos talks, and I want to begin by expressing my gratitude to the efforts of many people here, to the Lakatos Prize Committee, and to Dr. Spiro Latsis, without whose efforts the prize wouldn't exist. I thought in a forum such as this, I would try to give you a general idea of some of the key themes in my book and how they relate to some general problems in contemporary philosophy of science. These contemporary problems are actually the age-old ones that reflect what has always been of interest to philosophers of science, namely how to understand and also to justify scientific methods of testing hypotheses and learning from observation and experiment. So a central question that we ask is, when do empirical data provide a good test of or reliable evidence for a scientific hypothesis? Is it possible to have a general account of evidence for answering this question? The way philosophers thought to find such a general account is by appealing to ideas from logic. Logic, after all, tells us how to relate premises and conclusion, and might also be able to tell us how to relate data and hypothesis. Finding such a logic, it was hoped, would capture our intuitions about scientific progress, as well as show that science proceeds by objective and rational methods. If deductive logic can't serve to accommodate the inevitable errors and uncertainties in experiment, perhaps these can be accommodated by appealing to probabilistic and statistical ideas in some way or other. But precisely in what way? So in dealing with this general query, my discussion will revolve around two related questions. What is required for an adequate philosophical account of scientific evidence and inference in the face of uncertainty and error? And second, what's the role of and justification for probabilistic and statistical ideas in a philosophy of scientific evidence? How are statistical concepts involved in advancing knowledge by scientific experimentation? I'll try to give you some ideas about the problems that arise in asking and trying to answer these questions, and some of the solutions I attempt to provide in the book. Hopefully, this brief sketch will offer up something of interest and value to those of you so good to attend today. So to begin with the first question, what's required for an adequate philosophical account of evidence? It has long been thought that the way to answer this is to set out rules or logics for relating statements of evidence to statements of hypothesis. If we can't infer the hypothesis with certainty, at least these rules ought to be able to tell us how to assign degrees of support or confirmation or credibility to the hypothesis on the basis of the evidence. I shall call all such accounts coming up with such rules evidential relations, or ER logics, or just logics of evidence. What they consist of are rules for assigning hypotheses, quantitative measures of confirmation, credibility, or probability on the basis of given initial probability assignments to hypotheses and given statements of evidence. Among the best known programs to come up with this kind of evidence logic were the inductive logics proposed by Carnap and others. Here, initial probability assignments were to be based on intuitive logical principles, giving what he called logical probabilities, based on choices of language. These probabilities could then be updated, given the evidence, following the formal definitions from probability theory, such as Bayes' theorem. By supplying this kind of inductive logic, Carnap hoped that philosophers could then provide the scientists with a way to compute the degree of confirmation to hypotheses given evidence. And this computation was to be analytic, or a priori, not empirical. However, severe limitations with these languages, conflicting measures of confirmation, and a slew of paradoxes and puzzles led to the demise of these inductive logics, I'd say by the end of the 1970s, although there were some elderly holdouts. Contemporary evidence logics could solve some of these problems by interpreting probability as an agent's subjective degree of belief, giving rise to what's called subjective Bayesian accounts. However, their reliance on subjective degrees of belief in hypotheses, among other things, makes this account ill-suited for those of us seeking an objective methodology for science. What's more, philosophers of science, since Kuhn, have questioned whether the complexities of scientific practice could be captured by any of the sort of unified logics that philosophers dreamt of. The feeling was that in rejecting traditional logics of confirmation, there's a sense of despair in constructing any general account for evidence. The attitude has seemed to be either it's going to be an evidence logic, an ER logic, or bust. Somewhat like the title of John Ehrman's book. If one is to find any rationality for science, many suggested, it would have to be in large-scale changes in paradigms during scientific revolutions. I'm thinking of the work of Kuhn, Loudon, and Lakatos. There's also a more fundamental change in attitude as to how the philosopher of science should see him or herself vis-a-vis the scientist. It will not do, many increasingly came to see, for the philosopher to continue to operate on the image of the philosopher sitting on the throne, issuing down pronouncements as to what ideally rational inference was. And so this will no longer do, it was felt. Philosophers, in fact, should be listening to scientists. We should turn to the task of describing what scientists actually do. We should, it is said, become naturalistic. And if we wish to know if data provides good evidence for our hypothesis, according to naturalistic epistemologists, philosophers should just look to science, perhaps with some psychology and sociology thrown in. But this strategy, just ask the scientists, will not do, not to mention they're likely to tell us we're all Popperians here. In the first place, scientists often disagree, not just about specific inferences, but even about general methods and measures for interpreting evidence. Now, there's an important role for philosophers of science to play in these disputes, but that's a different question. But the real problem with the strategy of just ask the scientist is that it will not fulfill our philosophical interest in understanding when and why scientists ought to use the methods they do. In short, it will not be properly normative. My position is we should reject this assumption that the choice is either an evidence logic or bust. That's a false choice. I agree with critics of the evidence logics, but rather than abandon the project of developing a philosophy of evidence, I urge that we develop a more adequate account. Accepting the status quo has allowed deep and fundamental challenges to science to go unanswered, challenges that have influenced the work in many fields, and has led us to abandon what has long been held as the key goal of the philosophy of knowledge enterprise. scientific inference is just too important to leave to the scientists. The time seems ripe to remedy the situation. Freed now from traditional paradigms for philosophy of confirmation, we can begin to take advantage of what we've learned from looking at experimental practice in the past 15 or so years. The data from experimental practice can serve not just as further anomalies for traditional logics of confirmation, but as evidence pointing to a substantially different kind of philosophy of evidence. What the evidence from practice shows is that when data are inexact, noisy, and incomplete, an adequate account of evidence shouldn't begin with given statements of data, but should include ways to grapple with the problem of determining if we even have evidence for a hypothesis. So an adequate account should include questions about how to generate, model, use, and discard data. We need an account that makes sense of the fact that there's often disagreement and controversy as to whether we have any kind of evidence for or against a claim, and an account that just spews out an assessment of evidential support whenever we input data and hypothesis doesn't do that. An adequate account should also motivate the ways that scientists actually grapple with these controversies. And in these struggles, it is clear that scientists regard the question of whether a given experiment provides good evidence for a hypothesis as an objective, though empirical one, not a subjective one. They're concerned not with a way to quantify their beliefs, but with a way to avoid being misled by their beliefs and biases, and especially by yours. To perform this kind of check requires something else that an evidence logic will not give them, and that is a way to assess reliability. Even when the evidence logic has done its work, let's say it accords a high degree of support to a hypothesis, we need to know something more. We need to know, how often would your measure of support give this much credit to the hypothesis, say H, even when doing so would be a mistake? If it would often be a mistake to do so, then we would say the hypothesis has not passed a very reliable or severe test. And an adequate account must reflect this. Okay. Probabilities enter in assessing reliability of methods to determine how capable the test is at detecting various discrepancies and errors, to supply what we can call error probabilities. And an account of inference that is based on error probabilities may be called an error statistical account. Let me then summarize the two different philosophies of statistics in what I hope is a totally non-dogmatic fashion. The evidence relation account views the role of statistics as supplying a logic of evidential relationship. Probability measures the degree of confirmation or belief that we are to assign hypothesis given initial probability assignments and the evidence. In this account, data E are good evidence for a hypothesis H to the extent that E increases the degree of confirmation or belief in H. Some accounts would require that the final measure be high as well. An error statistical account views the role of statistics as supplying general procedures for generating data and testing hypotheses. Probability enters to control the overall reliability or frequency of errors associated with these tests. Here, we'd say data E are good evidence for a hypothesis H to the extent that H has passed a reliable or severe test with data E. According to the three requirements I set out for an adequate account of evidence, what we need is an error statistical account. And let me be clear, it isn't just that the evidence logics aren't particularly interested in reliability. It is rather that were they to distinguish evidence on the basis of the reliability of the data generation procedures, it would actually conflict with the central principles of the evidence logic. You get an inconsistency. Where to look then for building an error statistical account? The place to look, I think, is to the host of methods and models from standard statistical practice. Neyman-Pearson statistics, error analysis, experimental design, and related methods. Still a largely untapped source for a philosophy of experiment. But in order to use these methods for a general philosophy of evidence, I have found, requires reformulating and extending standard Neyman-Pearson statistics so as to better reflect how these methods can be used to supply tools for learning from evidence. And by the time this reinterpretation grew into the account of evidence in my book, the picture had diverged sufficiently from standard Neyman-Pearson statistics to deserve a new name. So error probability statistics, or just error statistics, seems about right. Many expressed great surprise that I would turn to Neyman-Pearson statistics in building a philosophical account. What an unlikely source, they said, for an account of evidence. While they acknowledge that these methods are used widely across the sciences, they have also come under considerable attack by philosophers. Certainly, they lost the philosophy of statistics wars of the 1970s, and one really didn't hear about them much again in philosophy. But given the new emphasis philosophers have placed on taking their cues from scientific practice, what is surprising, it seems to me, is this willingness by philosophers to disregard methods widely used to interpret evidence in science. Yes, there are controversies, although not everywhere. They're used routinely to estimate parameters in physics and elsewhere without controversy. But even where there are controversies, it seems to me it should be the job of the philosopher to help solve them, or at least help clarify the reasoning underlying such widely used statistical methods. Now, the controversies in statistics have generated a huge and technical literature, but I think we can very quickly get a handle on the controversy just looking at this, these two opposing philosophies of statistics. In a nutshell, philosophers assume that inductive inference must take the form of one of the evidence relations logics, and Neyman-Pearson tests don't give them that. What they do, what the tests do give them, put it in a nutshell, are rules for rejecting and accepting statistical hypotheses so as to ensure that in the long run, erroneous rejections and erroneous acceptances are controlled at some low values specified by the tester. Neyman-Pearson methods includes those we read about every day in polls, they're just confidence interval estimates, and in statistical significance tests. Let me run through quickly an example of a statistical significance test. A standard kind of null hypothesis, little h naught, might be the assertion that there's no genuine correlation, let's say, between a disease like Alzheimer's disease and some gene like the APOE4 gene, abbreviated the E4 gene. Okay? And then the alternative h says there is a genuine correlation between the gene and Alzheimer's. Okay. The data will be, let's say, a report on the difference in the rate of this gene among groups with and without the disease in an appropriately designed study. And we wish to ask a question we can call the significance question. What's the probability of getting a correlation as large as, or even larger than the one we just observed, if in fact the null hypothesis is true? The answer to this is what we mean by the statistical significance level of the data. If the significance level is very small, this means it would be very rare to observe such a large difference just by chance if the null were true, and we say that the result is statistically significant. I think one can see usefully the significance level as a measure of distance from the null hypothesis, but with this inversion. Small significance level corresponds to the data being improbably far from what H naught asserts. And so if it's very small, say 0.01, the data is taken to reject H naught. The way to regard this test is as making it difficult to misinterpret the process actually generating the data. While the researchers on Alzheimer's had all thought that genetics played no role, and so they would have accepted the null hypothesis in the early 1990s, they quickly did a turnabout upon seeing the series of statistically significant results that Dr. Alan Rose is from Duke University in the US was consistently finding. And it showed him that he would not be wasting his time trying to develop specific causal theories. Okay. criticisms of these tests generally result from failing to heed two warnings that relate to the fundamental properties of statistical tests. Firstly, that an error probability like the significance level 0.01 is not a probability assignment to a hypothesis like H0. Probability assignments make no sense for a Neyman-Pearson tester in scientific cases where hypothesis is regarded as either true or false, and the entire account was designed to be independent of any such probabilistic assignments. If one does interpret an error probability like a significance level as a probability of the null hypothesis, it's easy to generate misleading and contradictory conclusions. But such demonstrations aren't really criticisms of the test, but just flagrant misinterpretations of them. The second warning, often not heeded, is that evidence of a statistically significant difference is not automatically evidence of a substantively important difference, or even a large difference. Despite the second warning, a common complaint is that significance tests are used in this automatic and unthinking manner, particularly in the social sciences. Lakatos was himself well aware of such criticisms after reading the psychologist Paul Neal and others. He says, after reading Neal, one wonders whether the function of statistical techniques in the social sciences is not primarily to provide a machinery for producing phony corroboration, and thereby a semblance of scientific progress, where in fact there's nothing but an increase in pseudo-intellectual garbage. And we know that Lakatos really did take this seriously because he placed this in a footnote in his book. I will come back to Lakatos later. To be fair, the criticisms come not just from a refusal to follow the warnings, but because of a confusion as to how to use the test correctly. These kinds of criticisms have recently returned with renewed vigor in the social sciences, especially psychology, where we see, for example, the 1996 meetings of the American Psychological Society holding sessions to decide whether to ban the use of statistical significance tests altogether as a basis for published research. These criticisms have even been given a colorful Freudian rationale, which is taken quite seriously among psychological researchers. First put forward by Gerd Geigerenzer, a well-known psychological researcher. On his Freudian metaphor, researchers who use Neyman-Pearson tests actually use a kind of hybrid logic. They mix together ideas from Neyman-Pearson with ideas from Fisher and ideas from the Bayesian account, leading to what he calls a kind of Freudian bad faith. What happens is the Neyman-Pearson superego conflicts with the Fisherian ego and the Bayesian id. And again, it's taken very seriously in psychology. The Neyman-Pearson superego insists on strict adherence to test rules as rules of behavior. You set out your null and alternative hypothesis, choose and fix your error probabilities, and now your test is on automatic pilot. A procedure that Gerd Geigerenzer says is reminiscent of compulsive hand washing. The pragmatic ego is the guy who gets things done. He violates this automatic specification and he suffers guilt as a result. The Bayesian id's wishful thinking interprets error probabilities as statements about probabilities of hypothesis given data, which is completely illegitimate. The result, he says, is anxiety and guilt, compulsive and ritualistic behavior that we find in observing scientists who use Neyman-Pearson tests. Now, doubtless, critics are correct to claim that many have been taught statistics badly, and Geigerenzer points up many confusions in texts. But I think it's irresponsible to turn this into an inevitability. Granted, the conception of Neyman-Pearson tests as mechanical recipes for automatic inference was encouraged by the tendency to view tests as rules for good, long-run inductive behavior. But this was really just Neyman's way of distinguishing his tests, or these tests, from the concepts then in use by Bayesians as well as by Fisherians. The behavior models do not exhaust the inferential situations in which Neyman-Pearson tests can be used. Surely Pearson himself didn't think so, something particularly brought home to me thanks to the statistician George Barnard. We need to show how statistical tests provide a genuine account of learning from data without misinterpreting the tests and without using them as mechanical cookbook methods. While Pearson gave us hints and examples, nothing like a systematic, non-automatic, non-behavioristic interpretation of Neyman-Pearson methods have been developed. That's what I have tried to provide. I don't mind, by the way, that there be some hybrid elements in this reinterpretation, say taking some ideas from the Neyman-Pearson formalism and the Fisherian one, but what I totally reject is the hybrid that is accepted as standard among many psychological workers, which leads to necessarily inconsistent interpretation of results. Okay, to take stock of where we are, our twin problems are, first, how can we formulate an adequate account of the relationship between data and scientific questions? Second, how can we understand and justify the uses of statistical ideas in learning from scientific experiments? The first question requires an account of evidence that can satisfy the three goals I mentioned. The account has to tell us about getting the data. The account has to be objective. And the account has to have a way to measure reliability of procedures. The second requires ways to avoid misuses of error statistical methods such as the Neyman-Pearson test and to explain the relationship between these formal tools and substantive scientific inquiries. Fortunately, we can kill these two birds with one stone. Once we develop an account of reliable evidence, we will at the same time have an understanding of how to correctly use the error statistical methods and models in advancing knowledge in science. The key is to make explicit the complex intermediary steps required to obtain data and use data to learn about hypotheses and theories. So I propose that we view data and hypotheses as related, not directly, but by a series of piecemeal links, which you can represent by means of a structure of or hierarchy of models, piecemeal links between primary models or questions, experimental models, and data models. Such a delineation of models isn't new. We find it in statistics, also in the work of Pat Supes in setting out theories. What I'm trying to do is use this relatively formal picture to set out an adequate account of evidence. The idea is that a substantive inquiry is broken down into one or more local hypotheses that make up the primary questions or primary problems of an inquiry. Then the experimental models allow us to ask whether the data provides reliable evidence for a claim of interest. But one can rarely answer this question in the experimental model, making use of raw data or direct observation. Instead, separate work is required to generate and massage data into what we can call data models. The leading philosophical accounts of evidence, the evidence logics we just spoke of, overlook this by starting their work with given statements of evidence. And in so doing, they actually forfeit valuable insights that emerge in studying the nitty-gritty details of data generation and modeling. These logics of evidence harbor a common presupposition by philosophers, namely that empirical claims are only as reliable as the data from which they are inferred. And so, if the data themselves require inferences, themselves fallible, it looks like we're going to be involved in some sort of infinite regress. However, the actual practices of data generation and analysis belie this presupposition, for we often arrive at rather accurate claims from far less accurate ones. Scattered measurements, for example, aren't much use, but with a little data massaging, such as averaging, we can take messy and inaccurate raw data and arrive at more accurate data by averaging and least squares. Yes, that means the data themselves are based on intermediary inferences, but far from introducing a threat to reliability, this is precisely what enables data to be self-correcting, somewhat in the manner of C.S. Peirce. The model data, in effect, reports on what we would have observed had we been able to measure the data more accurately and more cleanly. In the experimental model, some primary claim or question is asked with respect to a hypothesis about aspects of the experiment that are actually available. And because of errors and approximations, the data would rarely be expected to agree with a primary hypothesis, even if it were correct. And so the measure of agreement or fit here is very often to be modeled statistically, even if the primary hypothesis or theory is not itself statistical. Statistical measures of fit can come from many places, but the main thing is that in addition to finding a good fit between data and hypothesis, we need to be able to say that the test was really probative or reliable. That, at any rate, is what I said is absolutely essential for an adequate account of evidence. And so I develop a formal notion of a severe test, which always refers to an experimental test procedure, T. We can say that the data E produced by procedure T provides good evidence for a hypothesis H to the extent that the test T severely passes H with E. And H passes a severe test with E if, first of all, E fits H, and it has to be a suitable notion of distance or fit. And second, the test procedure has a very low probability of producing a result that fits H as well as E does if H were false or incorrect. Now, one need not start this way from considering a hypothesis and then seeing if the data provide a severe test of it. We can also start with the data and work one's way up, so to speak. And this is what we do with an estimation procedure, T. Here, the definition goes as follows. The data E provide good evidence for the set of hypotheses, such as the set of parameter values, that T severely passes with E. When a hypothesis H has passed, often several, highly severe tests, we can say there's a good indication that H is correct. There are good grounds, we've ruled out the ways it can be a mistake to regard the data as evidence for H, or that there are good grounds that H is reliable. That H is reliable for me means we've learned that H will or would often succeed in actual or hypothetical experimental applications. I call this experimental knowledge. And the real value of being able to control error probabilities at small values is not the desire to have a good track record in the long run. It's because of how this lets us obtain valuable experimental knowledge in the experiment in front of us by warranting severe tests. Now, as I've said, I have to leave things at a fairly sketchy level here. There's much more that needs to be said for a real understanding of the severity idea. But let me just emphasize one thing, and that is that the severity definition here should just be understood as a way of formally capturing or abbreviating the notion. In practice, the probabilistic assessment involved need not be obtained by reference to a formal statistical calculation. In fact, some of the very strongest experimental arguments are based on entirely qualitative assessments of severity. The other thing is that the formal statement of severity is really a pale reflection of the real-life flesh and blood arguments that we obtain experimental knowledge from. The overarching structure of the argument is guided by an informal pattern of reasoning by which we quite literally learn from error. Oops. We can capture it as follows, informally. It is learned that an error is present when a procedure of inquiry detects or signals the presence of the error, despite the procedure having an extremely low probability of detecting the error if, in fact, the error is absent. Okay. Now, this man, when he goes home and looks at the color and the width of the paint on his pants, will be able to argue from error that it was caused by sitting on a wet park bench. Okay. It's precisely an instantiation of an argument from error. Let me just instantiate in an outline sort of way the main roles for error statistics in this kind of account of evidence that I am suggesting. It's used to provide canonical models, standard models of the low-level questions with associated tests and data modeling techniques. Second, provides tests and estimation methods which allow control of error probabilities. And third, to supply techniques of data generation and modeling along with tests for checking assumptions of data models. These three tasks correspond to the three models, the primary, the experimental, and the data models, respectively. Now, I admit that the functions served by statistical tools to get at each of these three tasks don't just fall out directly from the mathematical framework in statistics texts. There are important gaps that the philosopher would need to fill in. This is especially so for the first task, and I'm going to limit myself to making just some remarks. How do scientists break down a substantive inquiry into piecemeal questions such that they can be reliably probed? These questions I propose can be seen to refer to standard types of errors. And as varied as these errors can be, strategies for probing them, I find, often run to type. Roughly four basic types of strategies. Mistaking chance effects or spurious correlations for genuine ones, mistakes about a quantity or value of a parameter, mistakes about a causal factor, and mistakes about the assumptions of experimental data. And clearly, in saying these are roles for error statistics, I'm using statistics in a much broader sense than the formal statistical models. But my view is that by understanding how certain standard statistical models probe questions in a piecemeal fashion, we gain real insight into entirely non-statistical cases. For example, philosophers of science are very interested to evaluate methodological rules, such as the preference for novel facts, avoidance of ad hoc hypothesis. And I suggest that these methodological rules can be seen as strategies for constructing reliable inquiries into these standard errors. And thus, these methodological rules can be evaluated empirically according to how valuable they are in learning from errors, you know, in the face of all the uncertainties. The framework of the hierarchy of models, with its flexibility to move within and around the different levels, is a great way to pinpoint precisely how inferences can fail. And inferences from data to a primary hypothesis may fail to be warranted in three main ways. The experimental inference that is licensed here fails to provide good evidence or severe test of the primary hypothesis. Or maybe the experimental hypothesis hasn't passed a severe test, or the assumptions of the experiment may not be met sufficiently by the actual data. Okay. Now, Lakatos's worry, after reading some of the psychologists like Paul Neal, was really an example of the first, that the statistically significant result may fail to warrant some substantive inference into some primary question. Okay. Paul Neal had rightly explained that in rejecting a null hypothesis, we really don't have sufficient evidence for some substantive claim. And in fact, by increasing our sample size, we can make the test so sensitive that we're practically assured of rejecting the null, and this makes it too easy to have evidence for some substantive claim. But scrutinizing the results using the severity idea can avoid this misinterpretation. And this is my last slide, my curtain call, as it were, for seeing how we answer that problem that Lakatos rightly had in reading Neal. Okay. The idea is this, thinking of the Alzheimer's case. We've severely passed the correlation hypothesis. There's some real correlation between the E4 gene and Alzheimer's, and so the researchers had clues about a possible genetic explanation. But they had not yet reliably demonstrated or even provided good evidence about some specific causal theory connecting this gene to Alzheimer's. The researchers, such as Dr. Alan Rose's, simply hadn't ruled out numerous ways that it could be a mistake to make the causal inference, the inference to the causal theory, from this correlation hypothesis. And in fact, it was really this evidence that led him to start to develop the causal theories, not provide evidence for them. So we can have that capital H is some causal theory, and the little h was just the correlation hypothesis. Notice that both little h and big h, the correlation hypothesis and the causal hypothesis, both fit the data. However, the test of significance severely tests little h, the correlation hypothesis, but is not at all a severe test of the causal claim. And the very same thing that lets us say that the causal hypothesis, the capital H, is not severely tested, is what prevents such a rival causal hypothesis from altering or threatening the severity assessment that is warranted for the simple correlation hypothesis. More generally, alternatives at higher levels in the hierarchy do not threaten the severity assessments of claims lower down on the hierarchy. This is what allows us to learn one thing at a time and prevents us from having to test everything at once. It's at the heart, I think, of what allows progress in science through changing higher level theories. Okay, I've given you some sketches about what it would be like to develop an account based on error statistical ideas. It seems to me that having an adequate account of scientific inference is really at the heart of key problems in philosophy of science, and many of these problems have gone unsolved because of the tendency of philosophers of science as of late to turn away from this task. And it's my hope that I can turn philosophers back to this task. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, Deborah. One of the many virtues of this talk was that it was so crisp and sharp that we've got plenty of time for discussion. And as before, we have a roving mic, I think, although I did earlier see the roving mic man disappear. Perhaps it's past his knocking off time. Let's give him just a minute to reappear before...
Oh, the mic person?
Ah, here he is. Okay, so question over here.
I think it was Ari Fisher who said that a scientist should not regard a hypothesis as being rejected unless he could produce a method of regularly rejecting it, which seems to agree rather with what you're saying. But one problem, it seems to me, with this is that it really assumes that statistical tests are discrete entities, whereas, in fact, another view is that we simply collect data, and that this arbitrary drawing drawing together of data in particular groups that we call as tests is somehow unsatisfactory. In an area in which I've worked, which is that of clinical trials, for example, the FDA requires you to have two significant results. But another view would be that this is simply silly. We should simply pool the results of two trials and have one result. Another problem with the Neyman Pearson approach is that as you change the sample size, it's not really so obvious as to what constitutes the same test, having moved from one sample size to another. Do you have any comments on these particular difficulties?
Yes, I mean, they're all complex. Of course, if we're just collecting data and we're not doing any kind of analysis, then we can't make an inference at all. The business about two significance tests, of course, nowadays, there is a big move towards combining the tests using meta-analytic techniques, and they're not always uncontroversial, right? Nevertheless, this extension I see is just an extension of the error statistical method, not a different account, that is, the combination. On the sample sizes, of course, I didn't get to talk about the nature of my reinterpretation of the methods. The particular inference reach has to be sensitive to the actual outcome and the actual sample size, kind of like making an inference about the effect size that you have detected. And so that's how I take into account sample size. Is there more?
Well, the technical point is, even if you look at the history of what happened, I think, in Pearson's account, was that the way in which Neyman Pearson, first of all, devised their reasons for tests was based on likelihood. And it was only afterwards that Neyman insisted on this particular error probability interpretation, which has some difficulties when the sample size changes.
Well, actually, the likelihood is very important in this account, and it should be regarded as a measure of fit between data and hypothesis. And Pearson, for one, was very clear that from the start, he didn't think looking at likelihoods was enough. It's too bad the statistician George Barnard couldn't make it today. He's one of the ones really responsible for showing how, if you just look at the likelihoods, and he worked with them, you don't have control of error probabilities. And Pearson thought that it's just impossible to assess this fit. Is it really big or small? Without having another level, that is, what's the probability of getting a fit this good if we're wrong? So I really think that the error probability idea was fundamental, almost really from the start of their development in 1930 or something.
Donald Gillis was the next person to attract my eye. That's the right word.
Slightly alarming thing to use. You contraposed in your discussion two accounts, the evidence relation theory is sort of the old confirmation theory and the new error statistical account. But I'm wondering whether they're really, we don't need both. You see, I'm fully sympathetic with your error statistical account, except that I'm more of a Fisherian. My superego doesn't work so well. But I think you need all the significance tests and all that. But I would argue that when you've taken a hypothesis, you've subjected it to tests, you still need some notion of the results of these tests confirming it. And I think you've actually smuggled that in, except you've given it a different name. You say, data E provides good evidence for a hypothesis. Isn't that right? The old data E confirms that hypothesis.
It's interesting. There, what I'm doing here for the purpose of this discussion, to provide a slide that would let you see as close as I could get, I could make the parallel statement. Although I admit this is not the usual way of talking, for me, it's not so bad. However, we don't assign a specific degree of confirmation. Okay. So in order to make these parallel, this is about as parallel as I can make them, that we would say we provide good evidence for the hypothesis if it's passed a severe test. But that's not the deep difference. I mean, the really deep difference between them is whether you have, in addition to this measure of fit or confirmation, some assessment of the reliability of the data generation and hypothesis specification procedure. So in short, there's really a deep difference between these two, going far beyond any way we could try to word our results to make them something I could put on one slide and, you know, help to elucidate the differences. So I don't think I'm smuggling in. Certainly, I'm not using any of the probabilistic formalism to assign a degree of confirmation. And it's my thinking that this is really the kind of positive measure, it is a positive measure, that we need. One that describes the goodness or the probativeness or the severity of the test. So there's a formal assessment, but it's not this one. It's of the test itself. So I don't know if that answers you. By the way, I agree with you when you said that we do not need both. Because I think we only need the error statistical account. You said... you said we don't need both.
My view, I'm not saying that you don't need an error statistical account.
Okay.
I think you do need that.
Okay.
But I think you also need... You need both, that's my point.
Okay, but when you say you need both, I don't think you mean we need this for inference and this. I think you mean that we need to have our error statistical account capture enough of a positive assessment so that we can not just say accept, reject, but something of the nature of the positive evidence that we have. I think that's possibly what you mean.
Anyone?
Yeah.
John Howard.
Okay, in the Neyman-Pearson theory you talked about early on, you need an alternative hypothesis. You don't test the hypothesis on its own, you need some alternative before you consider rejecting it. And then later in your talk, the alternative hypothesis seemed to sort of drop out and disappear. And I just wondered what your views were on whether you could become dissatisfied with a hypothesis or theory and think that it was wrong and there was something very basically wrong with it without having any alternative to put in its place.
Good. Yes. Looking at the simple significance test, we just looked at the one null hypothesis, somewhat like the Fisherian test. But here's how I see it. The way you would interpret a particular result, let's say it's a statistically significant result and you reject the null hypothesis, is to infer how much of a discrepancy you have indicated and how much you have not indicated. What I'm saying is, in effect, your alternative is going to be usually a directional one, where the null might say it's no bigger than 0.5, and you're looking for, let's say, positive discrepancies from it. So you needn't write down, you know, which point alternative. In fact, I think an enormous advantage of these tests versus, let's say, likelihood tests is you don't have to have point against point. That's a very unnatural situation. You'll have, a single null hypothesis, which is usually a simple one, and that's what I mean by point hypothesis, looking for discrepancies. And it's very important to be able to interpret the result, not as just accept, reject, but what's the size of the discrepancy that you've indicated. And that's what I would do in my reinterpretation of the test. Also, of course, the power function, the probability that you're going to reject the null hypothesis in favor of some alternative, is altogether essential. If you don't do it in planning the test, you should do it in interpreting what the results mean. And this, too, is part of the reinterpretation of the test that I advocate. See what I'm saying? So although I did present that simple significance test, the way I would interpret any particular result is going to look at some alternative in the sense of some discrepancy from the null.
Yes, of course.
Yes, I think I was perhaps thinking of sort of theories of physics where there have been times in when people have become very dissatisfied and quantum theory hasn't yet been invented to, you know, that sort of thing. Or before continental drift, you know, that there's a feeling that something's wrong with the whole setup we've got, the whole paradigm, but nothing to put in its place. So no alternative. But it's not really a matter of sort of saying we've got to move in this direction or this parameter has got to be bigger or smaller.
Well, I'm talking about learning from data. And if you've got one hypothesis or theory and you say there's no alternative and you're done and you have nothing more to learn, then I guess you don't need, you know, you're not doing an inference. But I'm always talking about using data to find something out, to make an inference, to learn something more. And that learning is always in terms of some more localized hypothesis and differences from it. Again, if you already know exactly it, then you're not trying to find anything more out. But I'm talking about methods where you're learning. And you don't have to have, maybe this is what you're saying, you don't have to have a substantive alternative theory. That's, again, an important asset of this account. But you can still be finding things out about how you could be mistaken about this one theory. And you do it by means of these discrepancies or alternative. Okay? They're not substantive alternative theories. They're just ways we could be wrong about this one.
I don't see any other hands at present, but perhaps I can follow my distinguished predecessor's example and abuse the privilege of the chair and ask a question myself. It's really on the smuggling theme again, only at a more general level. I just wonder whether you don't see some tension between, on the one hand, your rejection of naturalistic epistemology, which I fully applaud, at any rate, outright naturalism, on the one hand, and your insistence that the theory-evidence relationship is empirical on the other. I mean, doesn't that mean that somewhere there's a sort of thin, old-fashioned, logical, purely logical relationship between evidence and theory lurking in your fatter empirical account? In other words, couldn't you take out all the empirical elements and leave the bare bones of an old-fashioned logic of ER, whatever you call it, ER, ET, anyway, whatever.
I know what you mean. That's an excellent question. I say you could not pull out that much of the naturalism, if you want to call it that much of the empirical aspect, because just looking at the evidence and looking at the hypothesis and however many logical computations you do, you won't get the answer to the question of whether this data provides reliable evidence for the hypothesis. Nevertheless, I think, for example, I gave an instance, scrutinizing methodological rules. I think that scrutiny is empirical. I think also scrutinizing whether data provide evidence is empirical. It has to do with the actual problem, slings and arrows of experiments and errors. And you will need to look at the particularities of the data generation procedure, all of the things that would never appear when you're just looking at evidence statement E and hypothesis H. So I want to claim for this account, and this really is a very important thing, and so I'm glad you asked that, that it is empirical yet normative and does not reduce to a fancy computation at any stage.
But there must be some a priori elements in there, then, aren't there? I mean, just for, I mean, some sort of meta-level version of the straight rule or something that says stuff that's worked before is going to work, is going to be the sensible thing to try first.
In that way.
So
I mean,
Loudon style.
It's going to be
or whatever it is.
Sorry, no, I reject that. But there's going to be, of course, be background knowledge as to what are reliable ways to test data. What are reliable ways to test whether you've satisfied the assumptions? Let's say of randomization, and the main thing is to be able to argue for robustness of the account that even with a violation of the strict formal definition of randomization, that it will be close enough for you to assess good reliability of your inference. So there's background knowledge, but it isn't of the sort that I'm assuming rule R, the straight rule, or any rule like that. Of course, it's mathematics in statistics, but you have to always be able to show that you can use those mathematical models for some actual experiment.
It's a bit late in the day, but people are supposed to say where they're from. And
okay, Samir Okasha,
LSE. What their number is and where they'd like to go with the blind data they want.
Can I ask a question about, again, about the completeness of your account? Because I mean, it seemed to me that on the one hand, you did want to claim that we do end up we end up with a definite act of acceptance or rejection. But then on the other hand, you didn't seem to give any proof, and I take it you couldn't, that two incompatible hypotheses cannot both have passed, you know, these severe tests. So, I mean, presumably that's unlikely but possible, but doesn't the fact that it's possible mean that, I mean, obviously you can't accept them both if they're incompatible,
well,
you end up with a contradiction. So, I mean, isn't that an area where the Bayesians say, have something of an advantage over your account? I mean, the Bayesians who say, look, we're not in the business of trying to accept or reject at all. We're just interested in the probabilities.
Right. Well, I never said that the result is going to be accept a scientific hypothesis or even maybe a statistical one. The accept-reject comes from the formalism of the test. One of the main things I had tried to emphasize, and probably didn't come out so clearly in the sketch, is that the statistical inference occurs in that middle level, so to speak, in the experimental model, and it's quite a distinct step to ask, you know, what we get from that with respect to any substantive question. So we could play the formal game and use the terminology. One of the things I really want to do is keep as much of the terminology, because I want this account to be relevant to actual scientific practice. Keep that terminology, if you accept, reject, if you want. But then it's all in the manner of interpreting that result, first of all, and secondly, what it means for some substantive question. Okay? So I don't say that we accept or reject. The whole advantage of the severity idea is to be able to pinpoint precisely which errors you've ruled out. Now, with respect to something else you said, remember the second definition of severity where I had an interval, this is a standard thing, you may indeed accept and say that all the parameter values in this range so far are severely tested. This is what we do all the time, right? We have margins of error. We don't say pinpoint, you know, this is exactly the deflection of light. We'll give some range. And this lets you do that. So I see no advantage to trying to assign, you know, prior probabilities and posteriors to have a probability to hypothesis which doesn't mean anything. But what I do see the need is, again, to separate the steps from the formal statistical inference and the substantive inference.
I mean, isn't there still the possibility? I mean, you still seem to be talking as if the point of putting the thing to the test is that we want to know whether we should accept it or not.
A point.
I mean, that's presumably the purpose of,
no,
of constructing
not, not really.
Tests.
Not really, not for me. I would say that I talked about this yesterday. But the real point is to be able to find things out about phenomena. And generally that is not in terms of sort of you accept, certainly not that you accept the whole theory, but rather that you have ruled out severely some errors and also knowledge about the errors that you haven't ruled out in order to indicate what to do next. So, you know, this is part of a bigger story, all of which I couldn't get to today.
Professor Durbin next, down here.
I'm from the LSE, or was from the LSE, a long time ago. I like your approach because it's very consistent with what we do in time series analysis, which is an important area of statistics, where we set up a statistical model, and the idea is that is supposed to represent the variation of the data. And then we want to check out whether the model fits the data. And so we have what we call diagnostic tests. And we have a number of diagnostic tests. One will take the error. If I switch it off, probably. How do you switch it on? Oh, it's working.
You've probed an error.
You take the residuals from the model, and you say, are the residuals autocorrelated? And if they are, you know that your model isn't very good. It hasn't taken out the autocorrelation that's present in the data. And then you have another test. Since some of your procedures are based on assuming the errors in the model are normally distributed, you have a test of normality. And then you have a test as well, the variance of the residuals mm-hmm. has varied over time. And I think it's very important to look at the outcomes of these tests individually, because they're very informative about the fit of your model mm-hmm. to the data. And I simply don't agree with the earlier speaker who suggested that if you have two different tests, you really should put them together and come out with a single figure. I think it's very important from a scientific point of view to know exactly the various dimensions in which the data are. And if you try all these tests and you find that they're all consistent with the hypothesis, then you're very pleased. And you can use that for further inferences on the data. Now, having said that, I don't entirely agree with you that one shouldn't sometimes want to use some kind of Bayesian approach to in particular cases. I mean, it seems to me there's no reason why one shouldn't be eclectic about these things. And on some occasions, you might do one, some another, sometimes both. And, for example, I think it could be rather illuminating to look at the posterior distribution of a particular parameter given the data and on the assumptions you've made. So, although I think your approach, I'm very interested to find a philosopher who has gone into this so deeply, I think it's very consistent with what many statisticians do. I don't think you need to restrict it purely to looking at your error statistics approach.
There's a lot to say on that. One thing I emphasize in my book that I'm mainly stressing the use of statistical methods for issues in philosophy of science, modeling evidence, solving philosophical problems, scrutinizing methodological rules, separating that a bit from what you might do in statistical practice, where maybe you know a lot about great priors and so on. So the first thing to emphasize is that's my main interest. The use of statistical ideas in these philosophies. Now, what happens is if you're eclectic, when you're appealing to these ideas, is you will have contradictions. For example, in the Bayesian account, the sampling rule becomes irrelevant, you know, once you have the data, once you have assessed the likelihoods. The result of that irrelevancy is that you can have very high error probabilities. In the extreme cases, you can be wrong with probability one. If you start allowing methods like that in an eclectic sort of sense, you really get into deep philosophical problems. So that's why, again, when we're thinking about from a sort of a foundational point of view, it's altogether essential to be clear on, you know, what our principles are, what are the principles of relevant evidence,
what is irrelevant for a Bayesian, namely, distinguishing evidence according to the error probability of the data generation procedure, is highly relevant for me. And when you're looking to statistics for answers to fundamental questions like that, it really matters a great deal. But I will say, by the way, on the Bayesian, if, of course, you are dealing with a case where the truth of a hypothesis may be regarded as the outcome of a chance trial, then, of course, you have legitimate priors. I'm not sure if that kind of case you were thinking of. And true, I also allow that, you know, you can try different things, see what they look like, especially in well-understood cases. But in the case of building a philosophical account of evidence and using statistical ideas to do that, I think you really can't be a little bit Bayesian. If you want to be an error statistician, anyway.
Well, I think if there are no more questions, then I'd just like to say I think we've had two excellent talks today that show that philosophy of science is alive and kicking, both in the area of detailed analyses of particular theories in physics and concerning more general issues about severe tests and relationship between theory and evidence. But since we already thanked Jeff Boob, I think we should thank at this point Deborah Mayle for an excellent talk and for the way she responded to questions from the floor. Thank you very much. The fun isn't over yet. There's now a reception in the senior common room at which the actual Lakatos Awards will be made, and you're I think all welcome. So thank you very much.